Welcome to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw, where we dive into life lessons from entrepreneurs, experts, leaders, writers, and difference makers. They all have three things in common. None are perfect, all are humble, and they've learned a few things along the way. In What I Wish I Knew, they share those lessons with you. If there's one thing we've learned from guests on What I Wish I Knew, it's this. No matter the obstacles, these people always find a way. Please subscribe, follow, and rate us on your favorite podcast platform, and join our email list at whatiwishiknewshow.com. Jasmine Burton is an industrial designer by training and a social impact designer by choice. She's a believer that design can help solve important societal problems and that the next iPhone or app isn't necessarily one of them. Instead, she's taking on one of the biggest health problems in the world and one that ironically has had little innovation over the years, sanitation. In college, she founded Wish for Wash, a social impact startup intended to bring innovation to sanitation. She and her team won a six-figure innovation prize, and within weeks, they were working on the ground in Africa to test their designs. She has since worked in Kenya, Zambia, Uganda, Ethiopia, and the US. Her innovation success and willingness to take on big, nasty problems like sanitation is quite a story. That's why Jasmine has delivered more than 130 speeches on global stages and has been featured by the likes of CNN, Fast Company, TEDx, and Wired. In this episode of What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw, Jasmine talks about design as functional art, designing for dignity, and offers a perspective on the role that companies, institutions, and individuals should play in integrating social good into daily work. Jasmine Burton, welcome to What I Wish I Knew.
Thank you so much. Really glad to be here.
So tell us what got you here.
Yeah, so it's been a journey, actively still on it. I think there is never been such a time as we're in right now where we're really seeing the need for integrating social impact into our, you know, understanding of our day-to-day lives in our workplace, in our personal lives. And for me, sort of that moment came when I was a freshman at Georgia Tech. I started my product design degree program, and I really wanted to find a way to use design for good. And I went to a conference. I learned about the global sanitation crisis. And that was the moment I called my parents when I was 18. And I said, I'm going to design toilets. And the rest is history. So that's really the moment that got me in the social impact space. And really, it started with the toilet. And now it's so much more.
Fascinating. So back up just a little step from that, because you had obviously gone to Georgia Tech with an intention to study product design. Why is that? And were there aspects of design that you thought, hey, there's a problem, or there's something, a role that I want to play?
Yes. Yeah. So I always was a creative professional. I really wanted to study art. But when I learned about product design, I realized that there's so much power to it as functional art. It's creative services that meets people's needs and actually meets them where they are and takes them on a journey, whether that's, you know, a toothbrush that you hold in your hand, or it's a shoe that you wear, it's a car that you drive. The designed and built world around us really enables us or hinders us from, you know, living up to our full potential. And so kind of realizing that at a young age through mentors and, you know, conversations with professional people that were, you know, in the field, I really sort of locked into, you know, the power of design in the world around us. And so really, you know, my freshman year sort of learning the fundamentals of how do you build things, how do you make things, but then also how do you think in a way that's actually driving impact for people, you know, in the world. And that design thinking, that human-centered mindset has really been a through line through my career, this idea of empathizing with different people, different with different worldviews, different understandings, and sort of walking with them in their journey, whether that is, you know, an app development or website design and actual physical products, but, you know, meeting someone's need and understanding where they are so that you're actually making that user experience better. And so for me, that was really kind of the roots of kind of what design is for me and sort of what has been brought into my work in sanitation, brought into my work beyond sanitation. This idea of how do you actually understand and empathize with different types of people? And then when you get that feedback, you actually iterate. You iterate, you listen to them, whether that's in, you know, program planning, whether that is in product design. So that was sort of the kind of genesis of a lot of the work that I do, kind of learnings at Georgia Tech that have since kind of manifested in a lot of really cool ways in my career.
And Jasmine, you mentioned earlier your drive to go back to your parents and say, this is what I want to do. But what was the ultimate driver there? Was it a and I guess it all becomes a motive too here, but what was the driver? What was the purpose change?
Right. Yeah. So, coming with this understanding of design thinking, of human-centered problem solving, that's sort of the moment when I realized I wanted to do something impactful with design. And I went to the Georgia Tech Women's Leadership Conference, where I learned, that over 2 billion people don't have access to safely managed sanitation, and how, in particular, that disproportionately impacts the livelihoods of women and girls in marginalized communities around the world. And, being someone who had, was in college learning about, engineering and design, that's so crazy to realize that we're in this technologically advanced world and people still don't have toilets, these basic human needs. And so that to me was sort of the moment where it was like, there's so many opportunities to use design thinking as a bridge to help kind of in terms of equity and access and inclusion for basic human rights, like access to sanitation products and services. So that was sort of the problem. And to me, the next step in the solution was toilet design, which is still very much a part of my reality today. It's a very niche field, if you can imagine. But beyond that, there's sort of like the ecosystem around global public health and, clean water, access to, hand washing facilities. And I think COVID has showcased more than ever when we're saying, wash your hands. And there's so many communities that don't have access to clean water to be able to wash their hands or to, safely take care of their families. This is sort of the power of design thinking, particularly as it relates to global health and sanitation.
So on that note, Jasmine, I kind of feel like, when the average person thinks of product design, they think of something very sophisticated, the next version of an iPhone, a new airplane, something that, involves a great deal of, like high technology, if you will. And yet what you're describing really is something that so many of us in the developed world take for granted. And I wonder if, as a designer, do you feel like some of these basic needs were sort of left behind as innovation and design thought moved on to other kind of more glamorous or more challenging or more enriching projects? And then, then therefore some of these basics didn't really get anything.
Yes. Yeah. And it's crazy to think about. We have, like you said, iPhone is coming out with new technology all the time. It's like a really big part of so many people's lives these days, but the toilet has not really been reinvented at scale for like over 200 years, which is crazy. It's something that literally everyone should have access to and be able to use. Our favorite phrase in our organization is everybody poops, because this is, 100% of people poop, right? But the fact that, we don't have a place to do it safely and with dignity in a lot of places in the world, right, is just mind-blowing. And so I think, where design has been focusing and sort of the nature of the products that have gotten a lot of attention versus the products that haven't, really, makes the case for why there needs to be more integrated thought of, impact work in the STEM, design world, because there's so much opportunity to bridge people, to bridge society. Again, as we're seeing with COVID, we're all connected. So if somebody doesn't have access to a toilet in a, one part of the world, that's going to impact us in terms of disease spread and health outcomes. But even when we're looking in the US, there's so much opportunity to just do better when we're talking about sanitation and hygiene and health. I'm from Georgia, and there's a lot of people here that live on septic. Failing septic systems are a huge issue. And so how can we use design to solve really messy, gross problems? And I think that's a part of it. People are like, that's gross. I don't want to mess with sanitation. That's, taboo or embarrassing, or there's some, cultural stigmas around, designing around products and services that are maybe not approachable in a lot of ways. But if we can't talk about things, we can't improve the outcomes, and it ends up impacting all of us. So yes, there's definitely a big gap there in terms of innovation that we're hoping to help improve.
And Jasmine, how do you, you've clearly laid out a marker here that the world is different. Yeah. And, Mike and I talk to many owners of brands, and sometimes the channels are similar. So it's a grocery channel or it's going through a distributor. But here, in your drive and power to look for solutions around the world, there's got to be massive impactors, and detractors. And I'm throwing these out because I've not thought about this before, but I'd like to share some of the challenges that you face and how you've overcome them. For example, there must be governmental challenges. There must be infrastructure cost challenges. Yes. How do you, and you said earlier, you're studying a bit more on marketing. How do you, you know, how do you build this up? How do you kind of map it and go, where do we start? Because it's kind of an opposite of a needle in a haystack, isn't it? It's like, well, we could do everything, but we've got to prioritize. So for business leaders listening to this, there's always leadership and learning along the way. How have you looked at that, Jasmine? And I'm intrigued on how that's going.
Yes. Yeah. No, thank you so much for that. Yeah. There's a ton of challenges in this world. And I think, lots of opportunities to continue to what we say, we like to say failing forward. I think a big part of human-centered design thinking is talking about things that don't work, talking about why they didn't work, sharing those failures, and then, you know, learning from them. I think a lot of times there is sort of a tendency to say, hey, like, you know, talking about toilets, this type of toilet worked in this context. Let's just put it in this other context because we know it works. But not every context is the same when we're talking about culture, when we're talking about regulation, when we're talking about norms around water and sanitation. So I do think that there is a big opportunity to really just use human-centered design as a tool to actually empathize with different community groups, to fail fast, to fail forward, to fail cheap before scaling up solutions that may or may not, you know, make an impact. And there's a ton of case studies in the sanitation world where, you know, millions of dollars are invested, really incredible technologies that turn waste into drinking water. But because of that behavior change, because the community culture, you know, there wasn't that, you know, combined educational component, you know, it didn't pick up. It was a failure. And all that money sort of went down the drain. And so I think for us at Wish for Wash, we really are sort of operating at a pilot level when we're talking about technology, when we're talking about innovation, working with communities, making sure we have the community buy-in from government leaders, from headmen, chiefs, sort of whatever the cultural norms are of that community, making sure that they are sort of on board, making sure that we're sort of following the standard protocol. And then when things don't work, talking about why and how we can move forward. So we haven't reached scale when we're talking about product development, but it's because we're sort of doing this fail fast, fail cheap, fail forward before we sort of invest in that larger scale investment. So I would sort of recommend that's a big piece of it. But then I think also the, like you mentioned, the marketing behavior change communications component is so huge, particularly when we're talking about something that's so personal, like sanitation, right? Like people don't want to talk about that. But in order to actually meet their needs, you have to understand where they are. And so there's a big, you know, big academic space and movement around kind of behavior change in sanitation, but making sure that you're actually taking the time, money, investment to kind of actually understand where these communities are when it comes to their norms around sanitation, so that you're not, again, reinforcing things that don't, you know, have already been proven to fail, installing something that's not going to work because the community doesn't have water. There's, again, a lot of case studies of toilets that go in and people use them as sculptures or glorified flower pots because the community didn't know what it was. And so it's like, how does this keep happening? And let's talk about how we can use communication education as a tool for change in addition to the product.
So just to put things in context, maybe Jasmine, could you tell us a little bit more about what Wish for Wash is now and what's your vision for what it will become?
Yeah, definitely. So we've talked about, we started off very product focused. So we were a senior design team at Georgia Tech. We came up with this modular toilet concept. We really, you know, we're like, this is awesome. We pitched it to the CDC. We ended up, you know, being a part of the Inventor Prize competition at Georgia Tech, which is the largest undergraduate invention competition in the United States. We won funding. And from there, 4 weeks, you know, after being on stage with this foam prototype, we were in a refugee camp in Kenya piloting. So it was really this concept, this fast turnaround of like going from concept to reality, which I think, again, a lot of designers, engineers, makers need to have that experience of like, here's this really cool concept that works in theory, but let's put it in front of real people so that you can actually see if it actually works. So that's when we learned a lot of our ideas didn't actually work. We had to pivot, and, you know, in context, in culture, and, you know, in the reality based off of what the materials were, you know, in Kenya. But then also we came back and we pivoted a lot of our design from there. We founded Wish for Wash in 2015. And since then, we have three operating pillars: research, design, and education. So beyond sort of the traditional, the product, there is this component of research, understanding how can we move the needle of public health, sanitation, research to integrate more of this design thinking, human-centered problem solving. A lot of traditional sanitation research or WASH related research is kind of hypothesis driven. So sometimes you invest all this time and money, you don't have an opportunity to actually integrate that user feedback. You don't have that opportunity to actually generate insights from talking to end users. So we're really advocating for actually using this human-centered mindset to drive some more of the science to be more participatory and community-based. And then also in our education component, how do we actually build a pipeline of people who have this hybrid mindset, right? Of using design thinking, human-centered problem solving with, you know, technical STEM skills to approach problems in a way that's, you know, you're failing forward, you're learning from things, you're not reinventing the wheel every time. So we have a series of educational workshops and mini courses that we've been running with organizations like Girl Scouts, with different schools in the US and globally to talk about how do we actually build this next generation of thought leaders that are actually going to be working at these intersections, because it's so important, right? You can't just come in from a science lens. You can't just come in from a business lens or from a public health lens. It has to be an integrated approach. And I think that's really where we're seeing a lot of opportunity, particularly now in COVID, with a lot of manufacturing and product design things being a little bit stalled. We're seeing this opportunity to really grow some of our educational work. And so that's been really powerful to see over the past year.
And have you found, you talked, you know, about the different markets and behaviors. Have you found particular areas, countries, regions where you see the potential for growth greater?
That's a great question. I mean, I think there's been a lot of focus in India over the past few years because the government has, you know, a mandate. There's an enabling environment that's really conducive to innovation, particularly related to sanitation. And I know, you know, it's a big investment. It's a big cost when we're talking about scale, at least. Reaching, you know, everyone with clean water and sanitation is a big cost. So when you do have that enabling environment from the government, there is like a big kind of incentive to work there. I do think, you know, there's another side too, in terms of private sector business approaches. We're seeing a lot in sub-Saharan Africa around sort of innovative business models to drive behavior change, to drive sustainability of sanitation infrastructure, right? Like who's going to actually pay, and finding creative ways to get different types of customers interested and able to pay for sanitation services. So I did some consulting work with an organization called the Toilet Board Coalition, and it's really just that focusing on bringing private sector mindsets into sanitation to offset some of that public sector cost to make sure it is more of a sustainable, you know, venture in an economy, so that it's not just, you know, relying on the public sector to bear the cost of all the infrastructure, because that really is not proven to work over time. So I will say India has had a lot of focus. Sub-Saharan Africa is definitely seeing a lot of private sector innovators. I will say too, the US, there's a lot of really interesting things happening now. I mentioned septic systems. There's a lot of open defecation or going to the bathroom outside when we're talking about homeless communities in a lot of major cities, right? So how can we manage sanitation for communities experiencing homelessness? So I think there's a lot of really interesting work depending on, you know, if you're focusing on the government, if you're focusing on private sector, or if you're focusing on just like social movements that we're seeing in the US and the UK. There's a lot of really great stuff happening right now in sanitation.
You know, it sounds like from what you're talking about, though, it's sort of different audiences have a role to play in all of this. And, you know, whether it's government, it's private sector, it's education, you know, there's a lot of that. Can you talk a little bit about social enterprise, what that means to you? And how do you feel, I mean, do you see social enterprise as an enabler to resolve some societal problems going forward?
Definitely. Yes. I mean, I think social enterprise to me is, it really is unlocking the power of business to drive sustainable impact, whether that is an environmental impact, whether that's in social impact. There's a lot of opportunities to use business for good. And I think the social enterprise movement is really pioneering that. I think, you know, as the world again is very much shifting, we're seeing a lot more, you know, nonprofits, public sector agencies, bigger corporations sort of learning from the social enterprise movement in terms of just how do we integrate ESG or the environmental social kind of movement into our core competency, into the way that we move, into the way that we practice. So that's really exciting, I think, to see that it's not just these smaller entrepreneurs that sort of have this cross-sectional interest. It is sort of becoming hopefully the status quo of how everyone sort of operates to sort of see business, society, we're all, you know, connected in that way. And so I'm actually just started my MBA at Emory University, and I'm actually a social enterprise fellow. And it's really, really exciting to see sort of the integration of, you know, impact into MBA education and what does that mean for the future of business. So I think, yeah, for me, it started off as a movement. It started off as small enterprises, but hopefully kind of with the way things are moving, we'll start seeing it as status quo.
You know, and along those lines, I'm curious what you think about what's happened kind of in the COVID area. And maybe this is just my interpretation, but one of the things I feel like I've observed in business over the past year and a half or so is that when there were many instances where the government didn't do what many perceived to be the right thing, we saw, I think for the first time, at least in my adult life, just companies stepping up and saying, wait, that's not acceptable. And we're going to have to act in ways that we normally wouldn't have had to because government would have fulfilled their role. Do you see that spirit? Do you see that as something that's changed, or was that just a function of the time?
Yeah, no, I definitely think that it is, it feels like it's been this growing momentum that I think, you know, the nature of the times have really sort of shifted, and we're starting to see more and more of it happening in terms of, you know, the SDG era, so the Sustainable Development Goal era from the United Nations starting in 2015, sort of saying, this is a roadmap, these are our indicators of how we want the world to be better in all these different ways. So water and sanitation is definitely my sweet spot, but there's a lot of other indicators and goals. And I think the fact that so many businesses are mapping their KPIs and success to those indicators is sort of, you know, signaling that there is this, you know, greater vision of how do we actually integrate some of, you know, these bigger world problems into the way that we operate as, you know, businesses, as nonprofits, as, you know, foundations, all these different entities sort of moving towards the same goals in their different ways, which I think has been really exciting to see in a number of ways. And I think it also offsets, you know, the public sector, who has traditionally been, you know, spearheading a lot of these efforts and giving them an opportunity to find their balance, as opposed to having to, you know, find financing for everything all the time. So yeah, I think there's a really exciting shift that's happening that hopefully we'll start seeing more of in the coming years to come.
So talk a little bit about what is a social impact designer? I know that you've said that in your profile, and you've talked about what you do. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, so I think, you know, design as I see it is a service. It's creating something in a way that's actually meeting someone's needs. And so I think social impact design has been, how do you use that framing to drive impact, whether that's through sustainable sourcing of materials, whether that's through, you know, actually creating apps or user experiences that, you know, for people with different abilities that might have visual impairments, like how do you actually integrate different worldviews and experiences into the products and experiences that you're creating, and having that lens as a piece of the way that you build. And I think traditionally a lot of design and engineering has been focused focused a lot on, you know, functionality, like what's the greatest technology, what's, you know, all these different bells and whistles. But I think social impact design really keeps that at the heart of it. How do we bring people, as many people, into the picture, into this process, into this product as possible? So that's really been sort of a through line in a lot of my career. I think it's actually building up momentum too, kind of in light of time, so just see more people operating at that intersection, which is really exciting. Because I think, yeah, there's so much opportunity to design and create a world that is made for everyone and that is intended to last, right? When we're talking about the environment and social impact of that. So yeah, it's really exciting, again, to see sort of the movement and shifts in industry for that.
And Jasmine, coming back to again, one of your points you raised, the growth areas in India and the sub-Sahara, you know, I've done other, you know, brands and development programs where, for instance, you know, in the sub-Sahara, the penetration levels are small, you know, fridges, yes, freezers, et cetera. Just talking to the social side, with, you know, the onset of the growth in communication, you know, phones, internet, and movements around the world, how much of all of this is push and or versus pull,
right?
If you get my drift. So how much of it is is the snowballing, if you like, of people saying, hey, I'm aware of this. I didn't know this. Da-da-da-da-da. And there's a snowball effect.
Right.
And how much is Jasmine still knocking on a door and shouting loud?
Yes. Yeah. So I think that it is, that's a good question. There is a lot of push, I would say. I mean, I think, again, there has been, you know, an increased case for, you know, more people recognizing the need for improved sanitation. I think the pull part is understanding what that is. I think there's a lot of education, at least in sub-Saharan Africa and a lot of countries and contexts, there's been a lot of education around, you know, what it means to use a toilet, why it's important to use a toilet, why it's important to get waste away from people and what that means for health and the health of communities. But I think beyond that, there's sort of this archetype, right? Like this 200-year-old toilet concept that people are like, this is what success looks like. This is what we're aiming for. But if you are making less than $50 a month, you might not ever get there, right? Like you might not ever have the ability to have the sitting ceramic sort of throne, if you will, with like flushing water, right? That might not be an option for you. So there's a bunch of really, really interesting toilet innovations that have been developed in context, in country, to either in line with the circular economy, right? Like how do you turn waste into resources, into energy? How do you have something that's lower cost? How do you have something that doesn't have water? But I think sometimes there's a gap in terms of understanding that too is considered improved sanitation. And that too is something that's, you know, actually a great use of resources if you're turning waste into something like biogas or into compost. But I think a lot of that, you know, is behavior changes, communications around, you know, if people have been inundated or just seeing like, this is what we're aiming for. And then you bring in something else and they're like this, you know, I'd rather wait. I'd rather just use my pit latrine. I'd rather just wait until I can get what's considered good. And so I do think there's a bit of tension around that, you know, in a lot of cultures, honestly, because people sort of have a vision of what clean sanitation is. So I think there's an opportunity to really reframe that into something yeah. that is more generative. Yeah. And so yeah. people can sort of see the opportunity beyond what exists.
And does that become a generational theme as well, Jasmine? You know, the younger audience as a, you know, have access to internet, more social media, more, and discussions yes. and blogs and forums. So is yes. that your kind of weight of focus here?
Yes, yes, definitely. I mean, I think there's so much to just seeing what other people have and recognizing, okay, if this is what it means to have like a nice household or a nice bathroom where, you know, I would feel comfortable, you know, taking my guests into, which is something we've heard where people are like, I want to have a bathroom that I feel comfortable having my in-laws use, or like my neighbors will use it, or my church leader, whatever sort of that person is for them, where they're like, we want to make sure that we have this sort of status, this aspirational component to it. It's just as important as the physical technology, because if you think about it, there's so much to be said about people's bathrooms if you see them, right? In terms of the way that they you know, their priorities, in terms of a lot of things. And so I think that component hasn't always been factored into it. And I think social media technology has really furthered that, right? This concept of sanitation, hygiene, health is more than just a physical thing. It's more than just saying we need to get waste away from people. It's like, this is signaling who I am as a person. And so how do I make sure that's fitting, you know, those aspirational needs? And so that's, I think, a really powerful piece of design, this idea of designing for dignity, designing for aspiration, rather than just the function of it, so that people actually feel like they're sort of elevated and proud of what they have, which I think is oftentimes not something we think about when we're thinking about things like toilets.
Such an interesting contrast, because, you know, a few minutes ago, you're talking about the stigma that's connected to it. And yet at the same time, you talked about design for dignity, and it's just interesting that it intersects in the very same place.
Yes.
Let's shift gears for a minute, a little bit. I mean, you've also founded a company called Hybrid Hype, which is a really interesting thing. So can you share with us a bit about that, what it is, why you did it, and what you're trying to accomplish?
Definitely. So the Hybrid Hype is an independent consulting firm. And so I think part of what I started realizing as someone who comes from a design background, who also has a public health degree, who's now studying business, it's finding opportunities to intersect all of my interests and skill sets and function areas has been a challenge. And so I think that's the idea around the Hybrid Hype. Hybrid professionalism is becoming more of a norm, I would say, in terms of people having these cross-functional passions and interests and skill sets. So hiring or finding opportunities for like one, you know, just communications or just marketing or just, you know, one functional area, rather than having the opportunity to go in and out of all of them, it's hard. It's hard to find opportunities like that. And so that's sort of why I created this firm, so that there are opportunities to use design, to use, you know, business mindsets, to use public health understanding and science and qualitative research all in one place to sort of create outcomes for different clients in a way that enables kind of the flexibility of different skill sets and talent. So it is sort of a, I would say, a growing movement of people who sort of don't know how to identify themselves professionally because you've held a number of roles or you have a number of degrees or you have a lot of passions. And so finding opportunities for, you know, people like me to sort of find, you know, their sweet spot in the work world is sort of the goal of the organization.
So in putting that maybe in an applied way, so I have a 16-year-old daughter, she's going into her junior year of high school. What do you tell young people like her? Like if you, you know, you were that age once, but if you look back on the time since, what would be your advice to younger people still in high school and what they should study or what they should see as a future career path?
Definitely. That's a great question. So I have a couple of thoughts. So I think first it's important to have hard skills. I think soft skills are very important. I think hard skills are also very important. And by hard skills, it can mean a number of things. So whether that's having extreme prowess in Excel, knowing how to do graphic design, being a public speaker, like I think it can be more than just, you know, physical things, but having a hard skill that you sort of can own yourself, I think is really important in terms of having autonomy in your career. And that's been something that's been really important for me as a founder of a number of organizations who, you know, sometimes you have to bootstrap yourself, and having ways to just quickly be able to monetize skills that you know you can monetize, I think is really gives you flexibility in terms of being able to be profitable for yourself, for your company. And then also if you have things like loans, it can help you offset those as well. But then I also think, you know, having a sweet spot in a impact area is becoming increasingly more of a need, right? Understanding like what your vision is for impact in terms of, you know, beyond you, right? You might have a vision for your own professional development, but how is that going to impact the world around you? Whether that's environment, whether that's, you know, people, whether that's society. I think understanding sort of you don't exist in a vacuum. You exist with other people and sort of how your work can ripple into society and what that could look like. So I encourage, you know, all young people to really just practice this skill of crafting a narrative for yourself. It will change. It will always change. But knowing how to talk about who you are, what you want to be, the impact you want to make, and then iterating that over time, not only is a good skill, like tangibly forget, you know, college applications, but also beyond that in terms of the vision, the future that you're building for yourself. Because if you can't speak it, then no one else will understand it, particularly if you're like me and you operate at all these intersections. So I think, you know, having a hard skill that you can own and, you know, dig your heels into and have really, you know, really great skills in, also being able to write about who you are, who you want to be, and the story that you're looking to build. And then also figuring out kind of beyond yourself, what's the impact that you're looking to make? Those are the things I would recommend.
Fantastic. So building on that, then you've traveled the world, you've worked in a lot of places, you've spoken on a lot of stages, you've met a lot of people. What, you know, and again, it's still early days, but what have you learned from that? And what do you wish others could know from that experience, that worldly experience that you've had?
Yeah. So a couple of things. I mean, I think first of all, you know, getting exposed to different cultures and worldviews and mindsets is always a humbling experience. You know, coming in as someone who was heavily researching toilets or has a degree in public health and you sort of know all the things or all the science or all the practical elements, but then being in front of real people who have different worldviews, it is just like you just need that to understand that the world is not all coming from the same place that you are. So it's humbling, it's important, and it helps you just become a better leader and a person at large, I think. The first time I really realized that was when we were piloting our first toilet and someone told us that they didn't believe in using toilets because they believed that they needed to go to the bathroom in full view of their God, which I had never heard anything like that before. But in order to get them to use a toilet that actually was going to improve the health of their community, we had to sort of meet them where they were, you know, in order to have a mutually beneficial outcome, which I think, again, is a really humbling experience that I would not have had had we not like been in that country and context. I will also say, you know, life is an iterative journey, right? So again, as you're learning these things, trialing new opportunities of working with people, trialing new ways of communicating with people in a way that resonates. I know we've talked a lot about marketing and communication. It's not a one size fits all, you know, program, right? Like you have to understand that there's different people in the world. In order to communicate to them, you have to understand who they are, which sometimes takes time. And I think sometimes we live in this culture where, you know, we have things right away. We can build things on apps really quickly. We can change things very quickly. But if you're in the, you know, business of people and understanding people and working with people, sometimes it does take time, and recognizing that that's a good cost to bear. Because ultimately, if you scale up something that nobody wants or knows how to use, it's a waste of money and time. So I think these are some things that I've learned only because I've had the opportunities to be around other people who think like me, who challenge me, who recognize that, you know, their views are just as important, their understandings are just as important. And so how can we work together? So yeah, it's been an incredible journey so far. I'm still very, very early on in it, but it's been really great to be sort of in these experiences, so that I can continue building my skill sets to advocate and amplify the voices of others.
And Jasmine, do you have, I guess you do, because you talked about your narrative and changing it. What is your vision for the next two or three years?
Oh, that's a great question. So, I mean, I would say, you know, again, COVID has changed the face of the world. When we're talking about sanitation and hygiene in particular, we've never seen such a global focus on things like hand washing, on things like toilet paper, on things like, right, like all of these hygiene norms are being showcased in a way that we haven't seen before. So I do think that there's incredible momentum right now around what it means to, you know, work in sanitation, to get, you know, work in terms of access and sustainability. So we at Wish for Wash are really focusing on what it means to move it in this time, right? So we're focusing on our educational initiatives and building up a lot of curriculum right now that can be used in different organizations around the world to help kind of integrate this design thinking, human-centered mindset into a lot of this programming, the scale up. So that's something that we're really excited by. I mentioned an organization called the Toilet Board Coalition. So they're talking about this thing called the sanitation economy. So all of the private sector opportunities that have been untapped in sanitation, which again, there's a lot of momentum around what it means to use biosensors in sewers as a preventative health mechanism and what that could look like, which again is very exciting. But then if you know, on the front end of that, you need to make sure you're creating systems that are, you know, data privacy is included, that there's regulations around it. So that way we're creating systems that will last and not systems that will exacerbate inequities that already exist. So I think there's a lot of great momentum. So right now it's just about positioning in terms of education opportunities for us. Ideally, we do still have our toilet product that we've iterated three times now. And we were set up to do a pilot last year. We're hoping to be able to get back on the ground next year. You know, we'll sort of see how that pans out to see, you know, if there's a market opportunity for the Sofi Chew toilet version 3.0. And so we'll sort of see kind of what the future of the actual physical toilet looks like. But right now we're sort of focusing on these educational initiatives. So that's sort of the plan. But I'm in my master's, my business degree program right now, which again, the nature of the world is shifting, which is very exciting. So we'll sort of see how that changes the face of organizations like Hybrid Hype as well.
So on that then, what are the things that worry you most about the world today? And then conversely, what gives you hope?
Yeah. So I think my biggest concern right now is this concept called an empathy crisis, which I think I've talked with a number of my colleagues about. You know, there's so many big issues, so many problems, it's just a lot going on right now. And, you know, people sort of tap out, right? At some point, you're sort of like, I can't do this anymore. I just need to figure out how I'm going to best make it through these times. And so I think what the challenge is around that is when we, you know, move away from empathy, when we move away from trying to understand other people, their worldviews, we become very centered on our own I think that there's a lot of challenges around that in terms of policy, in terms of innovation, in terms of scale up, in terms of business. But I think what gives me hope is that there's this whole generation of people that are coming up that are really, really rooted in empathy and understanding and human-centered practices around themselves and around, you know, their peers, colleagues, family, and friends. So I think, you know, while it is a hard time, and rightfully so, everyone sort of needs to figure out the best ways to sort of continue to navigate these times that we're in. It is, you know, the challenge is figuring out how to best create and build this world that we're emerging into in a way that still is human-centered, still is meeting people's needs, still is creating impact. So I think there's a challenge, but there's a lot of hope coming up because, you know, there's a lot of great people that are moving into this space.
That's great. Well, Jasmine, this has been a fascinating conversation. And I kind of look back and, you know, take away a lot of those themes when you talked about, you know, about product design really being functional art. And you talked about how, you know, there's so many elements of design in everyday life that people sort of take for granted. And yet somebody actually did it. Somebody eventually, you know, designed a paperclip, for instance, and, right. You know, it's a simply elegant solution. Right. But that applies across all aspects of our lives, including toilets. And I think the other thing that, you know, really hit for me is when you talked about, you know, what are the scale problems in the world, and access to clean water is one, and sanitation is something that, you know, affects everyone regardless of, you know, of where we are. And yet there's so many overlays to that. And so the other thing I really admire when you talked about, you know, the hybrid notion, it really resonates with the ability to solve problems aren't really going to rely on specialists, but rather a bigger understanding. And I think it relates to what you were talking about. The empathy crisis is sort of our failure to understand each other. And that affects us in design as well. So for me, it's been a fascinating conversation. Really appreciate your time. And it's people like you that give people like me hope about the future.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and for this opportunity. And so, yeah, really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Jasmine. And just to echo Mike's, for me to take out this dignity piece in design is something I've never been aware of. And that linked into your empathy is so strong, because in the first set of the discussion, you're meeting an unmet need here, which is fantastic. But you're doing it with different parameters than a lot of innovations and product development is, as you know, in certainly the fast-moving consumer goods market. It's a very different approach to success, and fascinated by the success that you're going to have in the future there.
Yes, well, thank you so much. Yeah, I really appreciate it. And yes, I'm hopeful for, you know, how we can all sort of utilize some of these, you know, skills, the understanding of dignity, recognizing that, you know, it is a big player in all of our lives, regardless of who we are, where we're from, our background. And then using that as that understanding to help build a more empathetic world, because ultimately it, you know, affects businesses, it affects society at large. So yeah, really, really great to have this conversation with y'all. Appreciate it.
We do hope you enjoyed this podcast. And thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics. If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.